Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Marca Mesut Özil. El envío al área, el remate. Y ahí está el primer tanto del partido. No lo celebra, por supuesto, Aaron Ramsey. 0-1 para el Arsenal.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello there and welcome to another Arscast Extra. As always, with James from Gunnerblog. Hello to you.
Hello.
Right, where to start exactly with what happened on Saturday against Hull, a game that we were looking at as, if not a banker, the kind of game that we could put in a good performance, get a good result, get 3 points on the board, build a little bit of confidence and momentum and belief going into a run of games where, you know, against opposition of similar-ish standard. And, well, if that was a plan, it didn't quite work.
No. What did you say to me off air just now? How did you describe it?
A bag of shit.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's pretty accurate. You know, there was a decent enough first 20 minutes, wasn't there? You know, we started okay.
I thought that was really... I was really encouraged by the way we started the game, and we looked positive and threatening, and I think the goal, when it came, was absolutely deserved. We merited the goal based on the performance and also based on the way that we'd played. You know... Yeah. It was the archetypal, if the commentators had said, well, you know, there's a goal coming here because I think Harper had made a brilliant save from Cazorla and we, you know, we were just on top of them and then we scored and you're thinking, perfect. That's really the best we've started a game practically all season.
Because that's what had been missing from other games where we've started like that. You know, there's been a couple of occasions where we've had that kind of high tempo beginning, but we haven't got the goal to capitalise and cap it all. And then we actually... went and did it, and then you thought we were in a perfect position to kick on.
Well, what did you make of their equaliser? What's your overall feeling on that? Is it one that we were hard done by the referee and we should have had a foul, or was the fact that they got into that position in the first place down to our lack of defensive ability or strength, or what is it?
It's definitely a foul, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a clear foul. I mean, on Match of the Day, I think they said that Flamini's maybe a little bit... He suffers for not going down. You know, if he falls to the floor there, does the whistle immediately blow? Maybe. I mean, I do think it was a very strange refereeing decision. It wasn't just one tug. He sort of had two or three goes at him, didn't he?
Yeah.
And even Steve Bruce, I think he was questioned about it and they said, oh, it was an individual piece of skill. And he said, like, it was an individual piece of grappling. I think even he knew that it was a clear foul. Maybe there are other errors. I think, you know, Diame went past Monreal pretty quickly before he got to Flamini. And there's a slight sense in which maybe once we thought the free kick had been given, we slightly switched off. You know, the players around slightly stopped in their tracks. But he was through by then. He was gone. And, you know, I think it was a real oversight from the referee. And I think that's really the primary thing. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is that sometimes... You know, in the anger and frustration, it's too easy to suggest that a player should have done better or more when there's an obvious foul on him. And I'm not, you know, suggesting Flamini is the most brilliant player or anything like that. But I think, you know, as I said on Arsblog yesterday, that if it's a forward that goes through and is fouled and the referee doesn't give it, you're furious because... Well, you know, you're not saying, well, he should be stronger, he should hold off the defender. If it's a foul, it's a foul. And I think Flamini had done pretty much everything right in terms of getting ahead of Diame, putting himself in front of him. And then when he was pulled back, I think he was actually just trying to kick the ball back to Szczesny. Instead, it rebounds straight into Diame's path. And, you know, I think we were pretty hard done by then. What was worse for me was... the way that the goal took the wind out of our sails, as if that first 15, 20 minutes hadn't happened. That,
yeah,
for
I mean,
me
that, isn't
worse.
That the most? That's the most galling thing, isn't it? I think because when something like that happens, what you hope is that it will galvanise the team and they'll want to fight back and respond to it. But instead, it just seemed to puncture the whole performance, really. And you know, we arguably just never recovered from the equaliser.
The second goal that they scored 31 seconds into the second half, you know, I don't know how to even talk about my reaction to that, because I was just sitting here watching the game, doing the live blog, and you're just sort of getting started and you're looking at it going, what? How the fuck does that happen? You know,
infuriating, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely crazy. And Arsene Wenger talked about the team lacking focus coming out for the second half. Now, you know, that's something we can analyze and jump on. To a certain extent, I guess there is, you know, he's trying to provide an explanation for something which is ridiculous. And it is a bit soundbitey that maybe we shouldn't take it at exactly face value. But at the same time, you could explain it away in other ways by saying, well, look, that was just terrible play or what have you. But to say we lacked focus coming out at home in a second half that you really want the team to kick on in, it's just, it's mind-boggling, really.
I mean, it might be a soundbite, but I think it's true, isn't it? I mean, that's the explanation for how they just waltzed up the end of the pitch and scored within 30 seconds. That's the only way I see it. I mean, there are individual errors in there. Per Mertesacker doesn't cover himself in glory, but that's down to a lack of focus as well, isn't it? He's not quite switched on as much as he should be. And I think it's just bewildering, isn't it, how a team can go out with that kind of attitude and not be on their toes in a game where they absolutely need to take 3 points.
And again, we come back to the reaction that it didn't spark Arsenal into life in any serious way, because Hull had brought on their third choice goalkeeper just before half time because Harper got injured. And you're thinking, okay, well, here's a third choice goalkeeper, and third choice goalkeepers are usually the third choice for good reason. So test him and make him work and make life difficult for him. And we didn't do that at all. And, you know, Hull were well organized. And we know from having played them in the recent past that, you know, they're a team that's well drilled defensively. But at the same time, at home, we just never got any momentum going. I mean, how much of that was down to us and how much of that was down to a lot of people talked about their time wasting, which is, you know, I've something of a red herring for me, because I just don't think we played well enough to build any momentum for them to disrupt.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, from a Hull point of view, if you're Steve Bruce, you'd be saying, you'd be slapping your centre backs on the back and saying, you know, you did a good job. They were disciplined. They were quite effective. They had those three centre halves and they performed pretty well. But I just don't think we did enough. I mean, the second half performance from Arsenal, I'd say it's probably the worst 45 minutes we've put in this season. Just because at home, with the players available that we did have, we ought to have been able of doing so much more, or to have been capable of producing more. And we didn't create, as you say, clear-cut chances until what felt like the dying embers of the game, you know, the last few minutes or so. A lot of us are wondering, is this third choice any good? I think most of us are still wondering. You know, we just didn't put him under any real pressure.
Made a good save from Alexis, in fairness.
He did make a good save from Alexis. You know, that save from the header was good, but equally there was another one, I think, was it Cazorla, where he parried it straight out towards Campbell. So, yeah, you know, there's a suggestion that there could be, you know, I think a lot of his football has been played lower down the leagues. League One, he was on loan. So, you know, we could have got at him and we just didn't come close, really. I mean, you know, that there was that header from Alexis, and then you're into stoppage time where you've got the equaliser, and then Gibbs and Monreal both had kind of half chances, not necessarily the players you'd want those to fall to, but for 40 odd minutes before that, it just didn't look like anything was happening, and players came on, Ramsey came on, Campbell came on, they added a bit of liveliness, but the midfield just didn't have the flow that we're used to seeing from an Arsenal team. I feel like the composition of that midfield has been tinkered with so much over the course of the season that familiarity isn't there. And all the great Wenger sides are based on patterns of play, but there's no real sense of patterns of play about what we're doing at the moment. It's just, it feels a bit thrown together and a little bit random.
Mm. I mean, there is obviously an element that the injuries were suffering, and this is not to use the injuries as an excuse, but to say that the injuries were suffering have prevented us building patterns or building players who are making combinations on a regular basis, because one week some guy's in, the other week somebody's out. But, you know, it's October. We're heading towards the end of October, and this team still has yet to really find its identity this season. And that for me is really worrying. And when you look at a game like the one against Hull, where you expect, because we're Arsenal and because we have ambitions, based on what we did at the end of last season and based on what we did throughout most of last season, you know, by leading the league, you know, we've raised the expectation level again, and we're falling below that.
We have. And I think it's very, very difficult to say that we, you know, that we've made progress. We look like we're in regression at the moment as a team. And I agree that a lot of that is down to injuries. I don't think that's helped. But it's alarming that, yeah, we seem to be going backwards. Whether that's because we're in a kind of transition, because we're still adapting to new signings we've brought in, I don't know. But it is troubling, because how long can you afford that to go on? We're in mid-October now, and we're 11 points behind the league leaders, and they are in danger of disappearing over the horizon, really.
Mm.
So it's definitely concerning. And even if you look at the top four, you know, there are sides who, I think a few weeks ago we were laughing at the struggles they were having, who are now above us. You know, I think Liverpool are one and Manchester United another. So, yeah, very, very, very troubling. I mean, what in that second half, what did you feel was the problem? If you had to put it down to one thing, is there anything that you could identify as the issue with that performance?
That's a really good question. I don't quite know. I do wonder if our lack of stability at the back kind of inhibits us going forward in a way.
Right. I think that's interesting, because inevitably a lot of people will have responded to this defeat by saying, well, why didn't we bring in more defenders? Why didn't we bring in a holding midfielder? But, you know, looking at it on an individual basis, I don't think you could say that Nacho Monreal had a bad game at centre-back. I thought he looked all right, didn't he?
Yeah, I thought he was fine, but I just mean that, you know, in order to really attack properly, you have to know that you've got a relatively stable platform behind you.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I don't think we have that, because if you look at our corners, there were two or three in the second half where Hull broke from our corner being cleared, and there were a number of times where we had to get men back to make last-ditch tackles. Joel Campbell made a great tackle on halfway. Mm-hmm. I remember Danny Welbeck and Oxlade-Chamberlain running back to prevent what would have been a really seriously good opportunity for a side if the player in space had been somebody quick, and if we'd had an Arteta or a Flamini in that role chasing behind, if you know what I mean. So, you know, they got back, and I think then all of a sudden you've got forward players chasing back to dig in defensively, and it takes you a while to get your shape and momentum. I just don't know, because it's so hard to tally that second 45 minutes with the first 20 minutes. It must be something psychological, or something in the confidence or the belief in this team, because we could see from the first part of the game that they're capable of being fairly potent, move the ball well, move the ball quickly, didn't dally on it. I just think that sometimes when we're in a position like we're in at Hull, we have a tendency to try and do everything right through the middle of the pitch, if you know what I mean. We've got Wilshire trying the 1-2s, the give and goes, those little the Norwich goal kind of moves, which when they come off are absolutely brilliant. But when you've got a team that's got midfield sitting deep, three centre halves, and they're happy to squeeze you into the middle of the pitch, we just don't use the width enough. And I just think the players that we have on the pitch perhaps are more comfortable in that central area than they are out wide, and we lack the ability then to break down teams from wide positions. But, well, I like I said, it's very difficult to understand why in the first 20 minutes they can play in a certain way and then in the second half be completely and utterly unable to do that. Maybe we should give some credit to Hull for whatever tactical setup they used, which negated, you know, our positives or our strengths. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. The question I've just been pondering while you were on that was, I was going to ask you, I mean, I know we come on to the questions in a bit, but I was going to ask you, do you think our problems are primarily going forward or going backwards, as it were? Or do we have bigger problems in defence?
I think we've got bigger problems in defence, because I think, you know, if you're relatively confident that you can keep a clean sheet, then you can scrape a goal or nick a goal and win a game. And we've seen that with this team for maybe 18 months, you know, after we had that period where we defended terribly against Spurs, and we saw the Mertesacker-Koscielny partnership really blossom, and we scrapped out 1-0s and those kind of wins towards the end of the season to get us to the Champions League. And I don't think it was any coincidence that with that newfound confidence in our defence that we were last season a team that was top of the league for a long time, even if it didn't work out. We had that defensive platform, which I think was, I won't say obliterated, but I think the confidence in that was broken considerably by the bad results.
Yeah,
particularly
for sure.
Anfield and particularly Stamford Bridge, that the belief we had in ourselves as a team that could defend was evaporated by those results. Not so much the Manchester City one, but those two. And I think that if we could find more defensive stability, then we would be more able to cope with the games where things don't quite click as an attacking force, but you can still get a goal like Alexis got. You know, or you
for
can
sure.
scrape that goal in injury time when Alexis plays in Danny Welbeck, and that's a 1-0 win. You know, so I think it's certainly a defensive issue. I think there's a certain element of bad luck with Debuchy being out. You know, who adds experience and everything to the right back position. But there's absolutely no excuse for not having gone out and bought another centre half this season. And people say, why did we sell Vermaelen? Would make no difference. Vermaelen still hasn't played you know, this season because he's knackered. So,
no, good point.
You know, we needed to go and buy another centre half at least. And I think that until we find defensive stability, we are going to continue to drop points and silly points. Because, you know, how many times have we said, Arsene Wenger said it, well, they only had three shots on goal and they scored two goals. But that is the story of our lives. It has been for just so long now.
Yeah, first shot on goal invariably goes in, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you'd love to play Arsenal, wouldn't you? If you were like a half-ass footballer, fuck, you'd love a game against Arsenal because you could, all of a sudden you pick the ball up 35 yards out, you go, well, it's Arsenal, I might as well have a go here, and you watch the ball sail into the top corner. It's, you know, it's just, it's the Neil, you know, how many people have Neil Mellored us down the years? You know,
far too many.
You remember that
for one
fucking goal he scored for Liverpool a few years back.
You can't forget it, can you?
No, mostly because he was just so fat. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's really obvious that unless we sort things out defensively, we're going to struggle because we're not a team that's going to score five or six, even though we've got good attacking players. But, you know, it's just a bit of a shambles defensively right now.
Yeah, I think so. And I do think that going forward, I think there's work to be done as well. I agree with you. We've got good attacking players, but we're quite reliant on the individual quality of someone like Alexis because collectively it's not clicking as much as you'd like. But I agree that without that secure base of a back four that we can rely upon and that we can trust to not give goals away, it's very difficult to see how that attacking game is going to develop and flourish.
Yeah, right. Well, look, we've got a Champions League game on Wednesday against Anderlecht, and Callum Chambers will be back for that. But what do you think the manager is going to do? Because he's got an issue in goal because Emiliano Martinez is going to play because Wojciech Szczesny is suspended and David Ospina is not going to make this game. Does he bring Chambers back into the centre of defence alongside Mertesacker, keep Bellerin at right back? Or does he, given the fact that he's got a rookie goalkeeper, keep someone like Monreal there, put Chambers at right back and try and give his, perhaps his back four, his best four available defenders?
Yeah, well, I was actually going to bring this up later. Callum JP92 asked which of those players we'd go for. I mean, I thought Bellerin was a rare positive
yeah.
from the performance. Danny Welbeck was fulsome in his praise of him, and I thought going forward he was very good. He made a couple of excellent recovery tackles as well. Looked very comfortable. I think I'd probably opt to play Hector Bellerin over Nacho Monreal. I think Chambers is a little bit more comfortable at centre-back than Monreal, so I'd rather have him in there alongside Mertesacker, even though that makes it a less experienced back four. I just think it's one that has a little bit better balance. What about you?
Yeah, that would be my... If it were up to me, that's what I'd do. I think, you know, try and play players in their more natural positions. You know, I don't think Monreal had a bad game, per se, against Hull, but it's just not his position. I mean, he says himself, he finds it strange playing there, whereas Chambers looks a lot more comfortable. Bellerin is obviously a right back. And, you know, should we need Monreal from the bench at some point, then, you know, at least we have that option. But
I have to say... I'll be intrigued to see how Martinez gets on, because I know he's thought of very, very highly in the club and he's been recognised internationally at pretty much every level. But whenever I've seen him play, he's looked all over the place, to be honest. I remember him in that Carling Cup game at Reading a little while back.
Yeah.
I know he's had a loan spell at Sheffield Wednesday since then. I hope he's come on, because it'll be a significant test for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's done pretty well there at times, and I think it was Chris Kirkland at Sheffield Wednesday that he was competing with, and he got a fair number of games. So, you know, goalkeepers mature at a slower rate, but again, he's our third choice goalkeeper, and he's our third choice goalkeeper for a reason. You know, we've seen it in the past where Manone has come in and had some good games, so we'll have to hope for more of the same from Martinez. Good luck to him, I say.
Yeah, good luck to him, as long as he doesn't play like Manone did this weekend.
Poor Vito. Okay, look, what we're going to do is take a short break now. We'll be back with some of your questions in part two. This week's Arscast Extra is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial to their service, just go to audibletrial.com/Arscast. That's audibletrial.com/Arscast, and you can get a book in your ear. Every sign-up does help us here on the Arscast Extra, helps keep things going, so it's all very much appreciated. It's audibletrial.com/Arscast. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. As always, this is the part where we answer questions sent to us on Twitter, at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog. Thank you indeed for all your questions every week. We can't get to all of them, obviously, because there's millions. Literally millions.
We wasted most of the time counting. That's why we can't answer them all.
Yeah, that's why we take a break in the middle just to count them. But thank you all indeed for those questions, and apologies if we can't get to yours, but we do try our best to get to as many as possible. So without further ado, this one comes from Dublin Gunner, at Dublin Gunner. And he wants to know, was Jackie Oatley out of order on Match of the Day, or did she ask proper searching questions of Arsene Wenger? And if you haven't seen the video, there's a video of BBC's Jackie Oatley talking to Arsene Wenger after the game, and it got a little bit edgy, you might say.
Yeah.
What did you make of it?
What did I make of it? I thought she was entitled to ask the questions that she asked. I think she was doing her job. Equally, I think he's entitled to give whatever response he sees fit. I think he was a little bit ungracious in defeat, but I can understand that. You know, when you've just lost, it wasn't even a defeat, was it? Blimey.
Yeah, really that sums it up right there.
Yeah, that felt like one, didn't it? But, you know, he dropped 2 points. He wasn't happy about it. He's sick of facing certain questions. I thought it was telling that I think at one point she asks him what is to blame, and he interprets it as who is to blame. You know, there's a sensitivity there and a slight vulnerability. I think he's, you know, probably conscious that criticism will be building the longer this sticky start goes on. But in short, I think, yeah, she's allowed to ask and he's allowed to answer. I didn't see too much wrong with it on either side, really. What about yourself?
Pretty much the same. I mean, I thought the question, the sort of reply where she had said I can't remember what he said. He said something about defending or not bringing in defenders, and or she said something along the lines of, "Or you didn't win because they didn't come out of their half," and that clearly wasn't what he was saying. So I can understand him being a bit, you know, a bit cheesed off with it. But that's the nature of the game, isn't it? That, you know, reporters should, I think, ask questions, and I don't really have any issue with a reporter or a journalist asking a question. Or asking difficult questions of managers, because, you know, that's part and parcel of their job. And too often you get these inane bullshit questions from the people who do the post-game punditry, and it's just like, shit. And, you know, how did you feel about that? And, you know, they're terrible. Whereas I think at least she tried to get a little bit more in-depth as to why things weren't working for Arsenal, why things aren't working for Arsenal at the moment. I don't think she has any issue with the way that he responded. She said, I can ask the questions. He can respond any way he wants. I don't think it was particularly disrespectful or anything like that. What I thought was weird was Gary Lineker's tweet. Did you see that?
What was No, I don't think I did.
He said, must say, I thought Arsene Wenger was arrogant, defensive and patronising to Jackie Oatley in the face of excellent and fair questioning. Now, I thought he was just a football manager who was fucking pissed off at the way his team had played and the fact that he'd dropped 2 points. Not been defeated, obviously, but had dropped 2 points. I think if in those situations you put a difficult question to a manager, chances are you're going to get a reply that isn't always the most mannerly, or, you know, it's the circumstances these things take place in.
Do you think Gary Lineker's intimating that, you know, he uses the word patronising? Do you think he's intimating that Arsene's response has something to do with the fact that Jackie Oatley is a woman? Is that the insinuation?
I don't know. Only Gary Lineker could answer that. That didn't occur to me, actually, until you said it. And I don't think that, genuinely,
I can tell you that Arsene was just as grumpy with with all the male journalists in the press conferences as well.
Well, I mean, that's what I was just going to say. I don't think that Arsene Wenger is the type of man who would think that he would take umbrage at the question, not who was questioning him. I mean, it wouldn't occur to him whether it was a man or a woman. That wouldn't make any difference to him. If he was going to get pissed off, he'd be pissed off with a guy asking him that question as well. So maybe that was something Lineker took from it, but I don't think that was anything Arsene Wenger took from it.
No, I mean, I just wonder, because I think patronising is a really interesting word to use, and I wonder if he is sort of implying it. You know, yeah. A slight gender issue there. But I think that, you know, he was in a foul mood yesterday after the match, Arsene, and I was in the press briefing he did, you know, with all the journalists, and
yeah,
I think the final question was something about, you know, you're 11 points behind now, how big a concern is that? And there was a horrible stillness in the room, a tension you could cut with a knife, because no one likes facing these things. But I thought Jackie Oatley did a good job, because ultimately, as fans, we want answers to these questions as well, don't we? I think, you know, and having people who are prepared to actually address the key issues rather than just sort of glossing over them, and, as you say, just dealing in cliches and dull questions that we hear week in, week out, is great, really. And I think that she was right to push him, and I don't think he was massively wrong to respond in the way that he did.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's pure storm in a teacup stuff for me, and maybe it's because we don't see enough of that, you know, not just with Arsene Wenger, but with other managers, that difficult questions, or questions that aren't the banal, trivial nonsense that you get game after game after game. Maybe when one of those questions comes up and we get a more emotive or human interaction between the manager and the reporter, that it's so rare that it becomes a bigger thing than it actually is.
While we're on this, did you have any particular thoughts about Arsene's post-match comments in general? Were you surprised by his kind of defence of the performance at all?
No, because that's what he does, I guess. I don't think anybody should be surprised. I mean, he always looks to take the positives from a performance as much as he possibly can. There are some days where he just can't. But for the most part, he will look for the positives, because I think he wants to keep his team positive. That if he feels they're lacking belief or confidence, that he doesn't want to say, well, you know, we're
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Struggling at the back and blah, blah, blah. So I think his public declarations, particularly post-game in the press conferences, are par for the course. When we win, it's, you know, we were good. If we come back, we had mental strength. If we didn't win, you know, we lacked a little bit something. You know, there's very rarely anything new about what he says. Mm. And I think anybody expecting him to be brutally honest and to unload on his team is going to be waiting a long time for him to do that. What he says and what he does in private or on the training ground, unfortunately, we're not privy to. I'd love to be. Because I can't imagine that there are, you know, there are days when he doesn't go a bit mad and doesn't chastise players or bring the players together to criticize them because of the way they played or behaved or acted. Because ultimately, he knows as well as anyone else that when we play badly, it reflects on him. So, yeah. So, but just he's never going to do it in public. He never will, unless you get whacked by Chelsea 6-0. And what can you say? There's no positive you can take from that. But a game where we didn't lose, and he, you know, this will go as part of a statistic now where we're, I don't know how many games it is at home, 22 games at home where we haven't lost. You know, he'll turn that around and use that as part of a positive thing. It's been X amount of time since we lost a league game at home. So
yeah.
So that's it.
Well, there we go. Next question?
Yeah, it's your turn.
Okay. What shall we have? All right, let's have this one. This is from Adam Leary. He asks, is it time for Pear to face some criticism? Abject yesterday and present for last season's shellackings. Nice guy, but is he up to it?
I have a Murder Sacker question here as well, and I think, let me just see who it's from. Boom, boom, boom. It's from Matt Horner, who also says, do you think Mertz is a lesser player without Koscielny there? I don't think he was abject yesterday. I think he was found wanting for the goal. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, I thought he was pretty solid. And he is, you know, a reliable, consistent player. I think he's formed a reliable, consistent partnership with Koscielny. And I think perhaps that we have the upside of that partnership is that we have two players who bring out the absolute best in each other. The downside of that is that when one of them is missing, it's very difficult for either of them to be as effective with another partner. So I take exception to the description of him as, what was it, abysmal or...
Abject.
Abject. Was, yeah, I don't think he was abject. I thought his defending for the goal was bad, but I thought the whole team for that goal... I mean, Tom Huddleston running past Jack Wilshere in midfield and Jack not even trying to stop the cross. That's part of it as well.
I mean, Tom Huddleston running past anyone or anything is a rare enough, you know, occurrence that you shouldn't be allowed to happen.
No. No. But yeah,
not
I mean,
a man
I think.
Blessed with speed.
No. And look, we know all about that. but I, you know, I think that, you know, yeah, you can certainly ask questions. And I think that perhaps part of the reason why, maybe part of the reason why he didn't feel as, what's the word I'm looking for? Like he didn't have to buy a centre half, like it wasn't so urgent, was because he's got this good partnership.
Well, maybe in part he was worried about splitting that up, or he felt he couldn't get someone who would challenge that too much.
But I think, you know, every player in every position in the this club needs competition for their place. I think that's normal. It should be the natural order of things in any football club. So, yeah. Yeah. So, what was the question again? I've lost.
the Adam's question was basically, is Mertesacker up to it based on, you know, his performance yesterday and, I guess, across the start of the season?
Yeah, I think he's up to it. I think he is a good player. He's reliable. He's consistent. He's a good organiser. He's a good leader. But, you know, I think that we get the best out of Mertesacker when we've got a fully fit Koscielny. And we get the best out of Koscielny when we've got a fully fit Mertesacker. And that is an issue then that harks back to our defensive problems. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, look, I really like Pear. You know, I'm biased in that respect. He seems like a great guy. And, you know, I've got a lot of affection for him. But I do think he's an excellent defender as well. I mean, in the first half of last season, in that run that took us to the top of the table, he was as important as anybody else in the team, wasn't he? I mean, more important than most. And he was credited with kind of helping to stabilise the back four, an organiser, a leader. So I think, you know, he's clearly got it there. I think he's not had the best start to the season. There's a little bit of a sense of a World Cup hangover about him. But I think you're right. I think what he's suffering most from, what he suffered most from against Hull was not having Koscielny there. And that comes back to the same error in the transfer market of not bringing in somebody who could, you know, easily slot into the central defence, someone with experience and who could provide cover for both players. Because this Koscielny situation is a pretty nasty one, really. I mean, we haven't spoken, I don't think, since that was kind of all announced. His Achilles problem was made clear by Arsene Wenger. I think everyone knew it was there, but some of what Arsene had to say about it sounded pretty worrying, really. I mean, effectively, it was like when he can manage the pain, he'll be back on the pitch, and that doesn't seem like an ideal state of affairs.
No, I mean, and they've known about that for quite some time. You don't develop chronic Achilles tendonitis in both Achilles tendons. It doesn't happen overnight, you know? No. No, it really doesn't. And, you know, that, again, is part of why there's frustration about why we didn't bring in a central defender, because, you know, we just needed it. It was, yeah, anyway.
And also on Mertesacker, I think, like everyone in the defence, he's probably not getting enough protection. You know, if you told me, even at the start of last season, even when Mathieu Flamini was kind of the hot new thing, you know, when he came into the club and seemed to have that re-energised spirit and was playing very well, I still would have found it unthinkable that he would be a first-choice player in 12 months' time. And, you know, I think it's a strange state of affairs, and the back four have been a little bit exposed by that side of things as well.
All right, okay, here's another question. This comes from Andy at Yorkshire Gunner, and he wants to know, should the board at Arsenal question Arsene Wenger, bearing in mind they say they don't? On the back of that fairly remarkable quote from Sir Chips at the AGM, where we say, well, if Arsene Wenger has a plan, we back him, and if he doesn't, we just, you know, go along with that too. Is there a danger, perhaps, of reading a bit too much into that? Well, I think, was he just trying to say that, well, look, Arsene is a football guy, and, you know, we're not gonna rock the boat there. We're not gonna say to him, you know, don't buy this player. But it did come across as fairly insipid.
Well, I think what he was getting at was, you know, we live in an age where a lot of owners or chairmen are criticised for being too interfering on the football side. And what he's saying is, well, this Arsenal board, we're not going to be like that. We believe in the old football club model whereby a manager is the guy who calls all the shots. Even so, actually hearing it that explicitly took you aback slightly, even though it's something we all know. We all know, we've all said for some time, you know, Arsene Wenger calls all the shots. He's the guy who's effectively accountable for everything, who's running this club. But to hear it laid out, you know, in those clear terms, it did surprise me a little bit. Should someone be putting more pressure on him? Maybe, but who is there who has the knowledge or the, you know, the knowledge required to do that? Is there anyone on at that level of the club, on the board or amongst the directors, who can look at the squad and speak with that kind of authority about footballing matters? I mean, maybe it doesn't take a genius to see we need a centre-back. You don't have to be an ex-player to know that we could have done with another defender.
But who's got the authority then to go up to Arsene Wenger and say, look, transfer window is closing and we don't have enough defenders?
I mean, Gazidis would be the obvious person, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but can he influence things in that way from a football point of view? Like, if Arsene Wenger says to Ivan Gazidis, look, here's X, Y, and Z, go get that done. Go do those things from a footballing point of view. Go buy that player. Mm. You know, that's what Gazidis is part of his job, right? But is Gazidis in a position to look at things objectively and approach Arsene Wenger and say, as the board, as a representative of the board or the owner, we don't think this is quite right or quite good enough. Do something about it. I that seems really unlikely to me.
It does, doesn't it? It does. And, you know, it's a point that's been made many times before, but, you know, so David Dean, for example, he had a kind of relationship with Arsene Wenger where even if he wasn't saying it in a kind of critical way, he could make that point to him personally and talk the manager round on certain things.
Yeah.
I'm not sure Gazidis wields that kind of influence.
No.
I think Wenger effectively... You know, Gazidis works for Wenger, not the other way around, it seems to me.
Yeah, maybe maybe Josh Kroenke can come in and say, you know, Arsene, we need a new relief pitcher. Go get one, or else Stan's going to be really unhappy.
A relief pitcher sounds like a jug of urine.
Yes, it does.
I don't think there is anyone there. And you know, one day... In the distant future, when a new manager is appointed by Gazidis, I imagine that kind of dynamic will exist more because it will be his man. He will have brought him into the job. But this is...
He'll be able to say, Phil Brown, when I tell you to do something, you fucking do it. And then don't give me any of your orange guff.
Well, we await the day with glee.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, for the time being, I think Wenger does call all the shots. What was the original question? We're really rambling on.
It was 1 second. Should the board at Arsenal question Arsene Wenger, bearing in mind they say they don't? Like, should they?
Should they? Yes. I would say so. I'd say it's in any company or in any sort of structure, any business, if you want to use that horrible word, any club, any football club, that's a healthy thing. You know, for demands to be put upon people who are effectively employees, whichever way you slice it.
I mean, I don't suppose it has to be quite as specific as, okay, we've looked at the squad and we think you need X, but like, surely at the start of a season there should be something put in place where, right, you should have, you know, X amount of defenders, X amount of midfielders, X amount of forwards, you know, and if there's a glaringly obvious gap in one of those areas, then, you know, as part of your remit, you've got to sort that out.
Yeah, but what happens if, let's say I'm Ivan Gazidis or Ivan Gazidis, I'm not really sure which it is, and I sit down with you can be Arsene Wenger,
okay,
and I say this, and I say this season, you know, we want to challenge for the Premier League and challenge for the Champions League. There are aims as a club. Do you think you've got a squad capable of doing that? And Arsene Wenger, say, as I imagine he would, yes.
Look, yes.
Exactly. What can I do about that? Even if I can see objectively that there is a kind of numerical issue, if Arsene Wenger sat there and he's saying, well, I can play Monreal as a centre-back, or, well, I have Sonogo. What, you know, ultimately that's his judgment, isn't it? And
yeah,
what more can the board even do, even if they do challenge it? They can't force a player upon him, can they?
No, that's a very good point, actually. It is. And that, I suppose, comes down to the amount of power that Arsene Wenger has as the manager, the football manager of the club. And until such time as Phil Brown is the manager, that ain't going to change.
Yeah. And I think as well, that's what kills stories like the mad thing about did Gazidis buy Danny Welbeck? Because to be honest, if Gazidis had the power to buy Danny Welbeck, he would have bought a centre-back as well.
Mm.
And he didn't.
So no, he didn't.
We are where we are.
We are indeed. All right, let's have another one from you.
Another one from you. Or me, even.
Yes, you. By you, I mean you. And
I see. You threw me there.
Yeah.
Okay, this one is from B. Morris. Has he got a full name? Ben Morris. And he asks, while Mesut Ozil is out, should we experiment with Alexis playing behind the striker?
Well, you know what? It may not be the worst idea in the world, to be honest, because he created that goal for Danny Welbeck, from a really central position, having picked the ball up slightly on the left. He came into the middle, and there was I was impressed by not just the run, because he's always at that, the running and the twisting and turning, but I was impressed by the vision to see Welbeck in the space and be the delivery into him. It was quite a bit more subtle than I thought he was capable of. So it might not be the worst thing in the world, especially when Theo Walcott is coming back in the not too distant future. And there were some questions about where does Theo Walcott fit into this team now that he's fit. I think the obvious answer there is where he always plays, which is on the right-hand side. I don't think there's any real issue about that, unless we significantly change our formation. So I suppose that has to be balanced with his tendency to be a bit robbed of possession from time to time. But look, you know, if he's going to persist with a 4-1-4-1, then maybe it's not the worst idea. I would have no problem with it, really. I'd like to see it for a couple of games. And if it doesn't work out, it's not like we don't have options. So, yeah, why not?
Why not? Give it a whirl.
Yeah. Would you?
I don't know. I mean, maybe. He seems to be doing all right on flank. That's the only thing I think. You know, whether he plays right wing, left wing. You know, he started on the right wing yesterday, scored that brilliant goal. And then, you know, switched over to the left and cut inside to create the equaliser.
Yeah.
I think he's such an effective player. He can kind of play wherever he wants. I think it depends how else you fit people in. I mean, maybe you'd get more out of him through the middle, but I don't think it's the most pressing thing. It's an interesting idea. I'd like to see it tried out, but there are a few things I'd like to see experimented with. It's just how much we can afford experimentation now.
Come on then. What would you like to be experimented with or on or at or what? Go on, what would you do?
Well, I'd still like to see a front two. I know that it's something we've gone on about before.
Mm.
But, you know, rather than say, I'll put Alexis as your central attacking midfielder, I'd like to see him up there paired with Welbeck. The issue is, have you got a central midfield that can survive that? You know, do we need to play with three central midfielders in order to have enough cover for the defence? I don't know. Probably we do need three central midfielders at the moment, because the guys we've got in the holding roles aren't really convincing. So it's a tricky one, isn't it?
Mm, so you're looking at playing, what, 4-4-2? Well, I don't know. I've lost count already.
That's
4-2-2-2, or, you know, the old 4-4-1-1 kind of thing, if not quite a 4-4-2. But
I mean, I've banged on about the diamond a fair bit, you know, that
that's true.
Play Arteta at the base and then Ramsey Wilshere either side, and then I don't know, Cazorla at the top of it. It seems to me there you've got, you know, your four best midfielders in their best positions, and then you could have Alexis and Welbeck as your front two. Whether or not that would leave our often exposed fullbacks even more isolated, I don't know. To be honest, it seems worth a try. It feels like what we've got isn't working.
Mm.
But we know that the manager's unlikely to do that. But as a fantasy,
yeah,
it's nice. It's a thought.
Is there anything else you would try apart from the two up front?
Three goalies, maybe? I don't know. I don't know. You know, every time someone has a shot, they're going in. So
yeah.
Yeah, see if we can get, I don't know, Martinez in there alongside Chesney.
All right, here's a question from at Macho underscore Grande 1. Are you over Macho Grande? That's an airplane movie reference, if you don't get it.
Oh, okay, very nice.
You should watch it. It's good. Okay. He wants to know, and he's not the only question on corners, but he wants to know, why do you think we scrapped the Mertesacker near post flick on from corners that we tried last season? It was something that occurred to me a couple of weeks ago as I watched corner after corner skid towards the near post and not be the first man. I wonder, was that an issue with Steve Bould saying, you should try this, it really worked for us back in the day, or, well, seeing as most of our corners go in that direction anyway, we might as well stick Purr there.
Well, I think it was implemented kind of deliberately last season, and I think it was there in the first couple of weeks of this season, but we seemed to do away with it. I don't remember which game it was where we had about, maybe it was Spurs or something, we had like a million corners or something and didn't create a single chance. And that's when it went out the window. It was in the first few weeks of this season. And I just feel like effectively they seemed to decide that it wasn't working often enough. I have to say, I think it was better than what we're doing at the moment, because at least there was some semblance of a plan.
Mm.
Whereas now it just feels like we're just chucking it in again and invariably hitting the first man, like you say.
Yeah, should we... I mean, remember when Barcelona were brilliant but tiny? Remember they had that team where nobody was over 6 foot? It was like a team full of magical jockeys winning everything. But...
the midget gem.
Yeah. But they, you know, when they got a corner, you're looking at, well, who are they going to aim for in there? You know, the giant that is Iniesta or whatever. But invariably, they, you know, as a possession team, they took their corner short. Is that something we should do more of? I mean, it's certainly a variation, given that most of our corners are shit.
Yeah.
You know, these couldn't be any more shit.
No, and we haven't got many players who are great in the air as well. Let's just tap it, give it to Alexis and see if he can just dribble through everyone from the side.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be a lot more effective than what we're doing at the moment.
I agree.
I'd be up for that.
All right. Have you got one more?
Yeah, I've got one more. This is a challenge.
Oh, okay.
This is from Lulu. I'm going to say it is the Lulu.
I'm sure it is because, you know, what else would she be doing with her days?
Well, the Twitter username is at Lulu Mister, so maybe it's Lulu's husband. And he asks, what were the silver linings from this weekend?
The silver linings from this weekend were Alexis.
Yeah.
Hector Bellerin.
Yeah, I thought he did well.
Danny Welbeck, in terms of his goal,
five in his last five.
Yeah, scoring well. You know, play him down the middle, and he will get you goals. It's just a shame it had to be, you know, a goal that salvaged a game rather than won it. And what else was a silver lining this weekend?
Jack Wilshere's not dead, as it first appeared.
That's, I suppose, a good thing. And I made a nice cake. And that was...
Did you?
Yeah. Yeah.
What was in... What sort of cake are we talking here?
It was a lemon drizzle cake.
A classic.
I find cooking quite therapeutic after a bad Arsenal game. Because I like to think of the eggs as you're smashing them into the flour as, you know, people's heads and stuff.
No, well, that's nice.
Not like chickens.
No. You know,
hens, I guess. Hens rather than chickens.
Okay.
So, those are the silver linings for me. And also, my daughter came home from Dubai for a couple of days. That was nice. Puts things in perspective a little bit.
Did she watch the game? Did she have any views?
No, she didn't. She didn't.
She probably had quite a good weekend then.
Yeah, she did. She doesn't give a shit.
That's a nice way to be.
It is.
I wish I could say the same. Silver linings, just trying to think if there's anything else. I don't know, watching QPR Liverpool was quite funny.
I was in the pub with the Mug Smasher watching that, and it was like, hey, oh, hey, oh, yay! That was ridiculous. That last 5 minutes was fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, it really was.
And you know what it was a perfect illustration of? Was the two Queen's Park Rangers goals that they scored on the counter-attack, the breakaway. Those goals were the perfect illustration of why you should take a man down in midfield and take a yellow card.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tactical fouling. It sounds cynical and it sounds terrible, but it happens to us all the time. And when you're a team that can break at speed, sometimes the only weapon against that is to be destructive much higher up the pitch. And if it costs you a yellow card, I mean, one of them was Carl Henry. I think it was Sterling who got away from Carl Henry. This is a man who would take an axe to a fellow player on the pitch if he thought he could get away with it. And he let Raheem Sterling, you know, it was great play from Sterling all the same, but, you know, he should have just taken him by the collar and just, held him back.
Yeah, on the TV they said, well, he's already been booked, so he wouldn't want to risk sending off. And I was thinking, have you seen Carl Henry play before?
Yeah.
I don't think he's bothered about it, to be honest. It's just another one for the collection.
Yeah. All right. Final question then from me, and it comes from Ross Adams.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at Ross Adams 33. So I don't know if he's actually 33 or born in 1933, which would make him one of our eldest listeners.
Good of him to tune in. Good old Ross.
I'm looking at his profile picture, and if he was born in 1933, the man has got some secrets.
Yeah, he's doing good
for
it.
Aging very well. He very wants nice. To know, very simply, Monster Munch or Hula Hoops?
Oh. You say simply, that's not an easy one. I'm going to go Hula Hoops.
Okay, why?
Because I like the sort of novelty of putting them on my fingers, pretending they're jewellery.
Yes, but, okay, right. I don't want to come across as offensive or anything here, but have you got fingers like pencils? Because
yes.
I too enjoyed that when I was a small boy. When I was younger.
This is maybe the memory.
Yeah. Now, they wouldn't even fit. You know,
I do have quite slender fingers, though, like a pianist. I remember once I put one of my sort of stupid song videos up on YouTube, and a lot of the comments were about my slightly frightening hands. So I reckon I could still...
Were they from South Korea, those comments? Or?
Yeah, maybe. But I reckon I could still squeeze into a hula hoop. But I don't know what... I mean, go on then. You think Monster Munch. Tell me why.
I kind of like the dust on the Monster Munch. I mean,
when
I'm a fan.
When you get to the end of the packet, they're all dust.
Yeah,
the
because they're corn snacks, so they're kind of covered in a weird fake flavor dust. I mean, my preference with crisps is, generally speaking, just salted. Like Lay's, whenever I go to Spain, Lay's classic salted, I'll just sit there and eat those.
Really?
All the time.
I've got to have the ham on in Spain.
Yeah, no, I'm very much into just the ready salted end of things, and hula hoops tick that box. But Monster Munch, not only is there original Monster Munch flavor, there's pickled onion Monster Munch flavor, and there were brilliant ads for Monster Munch back in the day, and then there's the dust, which is the polar opposite of the dust that you get in the bottom of a box of cereal, which is right up there with the worst shit of all time. That stuff is disgusting. And when you pour
off a box of cereal, like, early to avoid that dust?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
I would, yeah. Or, and I've done this, is that you strain it? Yeah, through a colander. So you just get
the dust out.
Yeah. That way you still get the full benefit of the cereal, but you don't get any of the minging dust. There's nothing worse than just pouring the last bit in and going, dust, god damn it. Except the Monster Munch dust is the good dust. So that I'm going for Monster Munch.
There we go.
All right. I think we've explained that pretty well.
If you stuck with us, thank you.
All right. Well, look, hopefully that was more entertaining than what happened on Saturday. And hopefully what happens on Wednesday in the Champions League will be more entertaining than edible and non-edible dust at the bottom of packets.
I mean, maybe they could just go out on the pitch and strain Monster Munch. I would watch that.
Yeah. I'd be into that, but maybe the UEFA and the Champions League sponsors would not, because their Monster Munch is probably not the official corn snack of the UEFA Champions
League. Bloody UEFA, foiling us at every turn again.
Fuck you, Platini. All right, we'll have another Arsecast Extra on Monday. On Friday, the Arsecast will be here. I'll be chatting to Amy Lawrence about her fantastic new book, Invincible, which everybody should read, but we'll chat about that on the Arsecast on Friday. So until the next Arsecast Extra, take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.